Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Before we get to a closer look, we begin today's episode with a special excerpt from Terry Gross's interview with Seth, recorded live in Philadelphia to commemorate 30 years of Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You can hear the full version on the Fresh Air podcast. Now here's Terry Gross talking to Seth Meyers.
Late night comedy has changed. There's like an unprecedented president opened up the door to unprecedented comedy.
Sure. Well, when the standard of what a president says drops so low, it seems silly.
When he goes low, you go low.
Right. Exactly. And I, you know, I always want to stress this because I think a lot of us that do shows like we do, that I do, my many colleagues who are really good at this too, people say, oh, you're doing the job of journalists. I think it's very important to note that we can't do our job without journalists. Journalists can do their job without late night comedians. They'd be just fine without us. But we, of course, use their work every day to build our pieces. But I do think that comedians have this advantage that journalists don't have right now because, thankfully, and I think we're all lucky as a society that journalists are trying to hold this standard and hold this line of what it means to be a journalist and the integrity that it means to be a journalist, whereas comedians are built for the Donald Trump era because we comedians notoriously have very low levels of integrity.
Okay, so your comedy is a kind of mix. I know what you said, you're not a journalist, but still you have to follow the news.
Yeah.
And then there is journalism embedded in the comedy that you do. To prove that point, we're going to play an excerpt of your interview with Kellyanne Conway.
Okay.
So first of all, just explain why she was your guest.
Yeah. Well, we actually thought, and I think we were right, that Kellyanne would be willing to play ball. She had been on Politically Incorrect. You know, she had done, before she was part of Trump, she had as sort of just a Republican voice. And the other thing is, you know, we want to have Republican voices on our show. It's very hard to get them to come on a show.
You just had Ben Sasse on.
Yeah, we had Ben Sasse. We had John McCain. Those are Republicans who have been very vocal against Donald Trump. Republicans who have supported Donald Trump do not want to come sit down and talk to me. Because they know, and they're right to think, I would ask them to defend him. And, you know, we did a week of shows in D.C. in October, right before the election. And it was very important to us to try to have even mix of Democrats and Republicans. We could not get a single Republican to come on the show. But Kellyanne Conway is, you know, she's well seasoned in doing it. And she responded right away that she would do it. And, yeah, and then we had her on.
And news broke just before you went out.
Yes, that was the news of the sort of...
The Russian dossier.
The dossier.
That story had just been broken by CNN.
Yeah.
And you had to go out, and you were prepared to ask her about it, and let's see how you handled it.
So I want to ask, this broke while we were getting ready for the show, while I was getting changed for the show. CNN had a report that the intelligence community briefed both the president and the president-elect with allegations that the Russian government has compromising information on President-elect Trump, both business information and personal information. I know this just happened. Can you confirm or comment on the fact that the intelligence community has presented this?
Well,
to
guess
Donald
what
Trump?
Hasn't happened, Seth. Nobody has sourced it. They're all unnamed, unspoken sources in the story, and it says it was based on a Russian investigator to begin with. So where are we?
I think it was based on an MI6 British investigator.
Right. Well, one of those, and then it said that it also may have originated with a Russian investigator. It also says that Hillary Clinton and groups that wanted Hillary Clinton to win may have been behind the investigations themselves. And most importantly, it says that the FBI is trying to confirm it. So nothing's been confirmed. And I have to say, as an American citizen, regardless of your party or if you don't like politics at all, which are many Americans, we should be concerned that intelligence officials leak to the press and won't go and tell the president-elect or the president of the United States himself now, Mr. Obama, what the information is. They would rather go tell the press.
But the report was the press report was about them going to the president.
And it says that they never briefed him on it, that they appended a two pages to the bottom of his intelligence report.
I believe it said they did brief him on it.
Well, he has said that he is not aware of that.
Okay. That concerns me.
No.
I'm concerned.
No, he is
but
not
in general,
aware.
I just want to... I
fair.
Understand. No, I understand
that's
not that...
Fair. And it's not true.
What is not true? That I'm concerned?
No, that I see.
Okay, I assure you I am.
Any...
Okay, when she was saying one thing and you were saying, no, I think they did brief him. I think you're wrong. I think this is what happened. Were you confident that you were right? Because when somebody is into spinning, and it's your job to figure out if they're telling the truth or not, and you're not an expert in that field,
yeah.
And you've just been briefed 2 minutes ago yourself, or however recently it was, did you have that confidence that, like, you could challenge her and know that you were right?
Again, it had just happened. A segment producer brought me the two-page, printed out the CNN story, so I had to put a lot of faith in the CNN reporting.
Right.
And but it seemed like, you know, this is an organization that I trusted in this case.
And you trusted your memory.
I trusted my memory. Although it was, you're right, it wasn't a subject I was good at. It was like I was ready for a chemistry test, and they said, pop quiz, it's on Tale of Two Cities. You're like, whoa.
So it struck me like that's an awkward position for her to be in on your show, because the audience is laughing at your jokes.
Yeah.
And sometimes they were literally laughing at her.
Yeah.
You could tell the audience thought that what she was saying wasn't true, or they heard her pivoting as you were calling her out. So that's a difference between journalism and comedy, is that when a guest is interviewed by you as political, the audience might be laughing at them instead of with them. But what are some of the differences for you when as the interviewer, when you're interviewing a political person and there's, you know, it's a live audience and it's a comedy show and they're laughing?
Well, one thing I'll say is before I interviewed Kellyanne Conway, I watched a lot of other people interview Kellyanne Conway, Rachel Maddow and Anderson Cooper and Jake Tapper.
She did a great interview.
Great.
Yeah.
But what I realized was I had this great advantage of a live audience, which no one else ever does. You know, she doesn't do a lot of interviews in front of a live audience. And so, you know, I ran into Jake Tapper and I was saying, you got to get a live audience. you got to get the lead with a live studio audience. But, you know, I will say interviewing politicians is very hard and a lot of times very uninteresting. And I think politicians by design try to be uninteresting. And they...
I thought that, too. My theory used to be that some politicians, their goal of being interviewed was to kind of lull the interviewer to sleep, mm-hmm. so that the interviewer would be so distracted or just so kind of sleepy that they wouldn't notice that the politician wasn't answering the questions.
Yeah. Well, there's a few things. One, you have to interrupt politicians.
Yeah.
They will... You can ask, say, one thing to them, and they will go the whole time. Just basically going over their talking points. I remember a politician who looped back, and it was as if they went to the end of the tape and just started going. We had Bill Clinton on, and I had 12 minutes with Bill Clinton. I'd done all this research. Again, I tend to work harder on those because out of a desperate fear of not looking stupid. And I just remember he sat down, and I said, how are you? And he just paused and said, you know, that's a good question. And I was like, oh, no. that was filler. And by the way, I should make this very clear. There's a lot of Democrats, particularly after the election. You know, I will try to pin them down and end on on mistakes that were made and how has anything changed, and the speed in which they say, you know, it's, you know, when you look at these people and these movements and they're in the street, energy, I'm like, what is this answer? What are you talking about?
That was Terry Gross interviewing Seth Meyers in Philadelphia. Their full interview can be heard on the Fresh Air podcast or at NPR.org. Now let's go to a closer look, followed by Seth's interview with Wonder Woman director Patty Jenkins, who also answers a few more questions backstage just for this podcast.
Yesterday, we got yet another bombshell in the special counsel investigation when we learned that President Trump is now personally under investigation for obstruction of justice. Meanwhile, Senate Republicans are quietly getting close to passing a health care bill in total secrecy. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Trump has had to contend with near constant chaos in his administration, from the escalating Russia scandal to his record low approval ratings. But yesterday, at least, was his birthday. And the reason I know that is because he wouldn't stop talking about it.
I've been talking about repealing and replacing Obamacare now for almost 2 years. Don't forget, on June 16th, June 14th is my birthday. We started really on June 14th, Flag Day, my birthday. That was June 14th, my birthday.
Trump talks about his birthday like a 14-year-old girl whose dad has a boat. It's my birthday, and we're gonna party on my dad's boat. Not you, Trisha, it's my birthday. But you know what? We've been hard on Trump here on this show, and I feel bad that we didn't get the chance to celebrate yesterday. So, Mr. President, we got you a cake. And I am just going to light the candles because, after all, it is your special day. I mean, how bad can things really be when it's your birthday?
Breaking news, the President of the United States is now personally under investigation in the Russia probe. This is according to a stunning new report from the Washington Post tonight. Their headline, Special Counsel Investigating Trump for Possible Obstruction of Justice.
So Trump is now personally the subject of the special counsel investigation, which is looking into whether he committed obstruction of justice by, among other things, firing former FBI Director James Comey. Now, there are a couple reasons this story is amazing. First of all, just days ago, after Comey's testimony, Trump and his lawyer, Mark Cassowitz, crowed that he had been proven right. Cassowitz said the president was not under investigation as part of any probe into Russian interference, and Trump tweeted, "Total and complete vindication." Trump is the king of spiking the ball at the 6-yard line. His timing is amazing. I swear, if he tweeted, "Only fat losers step on rakes," this would be the next thing to happen. Then there's the backstory of how we got here. Remember, Comey told Trump that he was not personally under investigation. Trump wanted Comey to announce that publicly, but Comey refused, so Trump fired him. And now, because he fired Comey, Trump is personally under investigation. It's one of the greatest self-owns in political history. "I want to get rid of this boomerang. Oh, I know. I'll throw it." Mr. President, in the immortal words of DJ Khaled,
"Congratulations. You played yourself."
Now, the timing of this news is also noteworthy because Trump's allies have been laying the groundwork for the potentially explosive move of firing the special counsel, Robert Mueller. Kellyanne Conway tweeted, "Mueller's team includes big Democrat donors. Some maxed out. None wanted Trump to be POTUS." And Newt Gingrich tweeted, "Republicans are delusional. If they think the special counsel is going to be fair, time to rethink." And in their defense, Conway and Gingrich have always been consistent on FBI investigations and attacking the Justice Department. And I'm just kidding. Their minds have totally changed.
I just think many Americans will say, "How many times have my friends and neighbors been under FBI investigation?" If the answer is 2, your neighbor is Hillary Clinton. People know this isn't normal unless there's a there.
There is something profoundly demeaning and destructive to have the White House systematically undermine an officer of the Department of Justice. And when I watch these paid hacks on television, to be quite honest, I am sickened by how unpatriotically they undermine the Constitution of the United States on behalf of their client.
Now, which one of you has my check for this televised hackery? I need to buy some Pepto because I have sickened myself. But it isn't just Trump's allies who've been floating this idea. Trump himself has apparently thought about firing Mueller and had to be talked down by his staff. According to the New York Times, people close to Trump say he is so volatile, they cannot be sure that he will not change his mind. For Trump, the line between whim and will is always thin. It is often erased in moments of anger when simmering grievance boils over into rash action. So the White House is basically a bar in South Boston 20 minutes before closing time. I'm gonna fire him. Donnie, it's not worth it. You need to cool down, Donnie. And susceptibility to rash action is a terrible quality for a president. Basically, we'd end up in a war with North Korea if Kim Jong-un forgets Trump's birthday. Although, how could anyone forget his birthday?
June 14th is my birthday.
Oh, we know. But this is by far the craziest, most naive part of Trump's thinking. When word that he might fire Mueller first surfaced, Trump chose not to push back on the reports because he thought it would actually help him. The president was pleased by the ambiguity of his position on Mueller and thinks the possibility of being fired will focus the veteran prosecutor on delivering what the president desires most, a blanket public exoneration. You think fear of being fired will intimidate this guy? He's a veteran law enforcement officer, not a trainee at Jamba Juice. Look at him. He looks like something you would carve out of wood to scare millennials off your porch. Now, the Russia scandal can feel all-consuming, but it's important to note that while the investigation moves forward and chews up all the headlines, Republicans in the Senate are quietly making progress on their legislative goals, specifically their attempt to repeal and replace Obamacare. Trump himself has renewed his push for the Republican health care plan this week, holding events in D.C. and Wisconsin and complaining that Democrats won't get behind it.
If we had the greatest bill in the history of the world on health care, we wouldn't get one vote from the Democrats.
If you had the greatest bill in history, no one would believe you because you call everything you do the greatest in history. You're like the boy who cried, "Wolf, this is the greatest bill in the history of the world." Now, aside from that, you've probably heard very little about the Senate bill, and apparently that's by design. Senate Republicans have been writing the bill behind closed doors with no hearings and have no plans to publicly release it. But Senate Republicans have been getting pushback from critics, and one of those critics is apparently the president himself.
Two Senate sources tell NBC News President Trump told Republican senators the House health care bill, which cuts some services, is mean.
The Associated Press is reporting that to senators, the president referred to the House version of the American Health Care Act as, quote, mean, mean, mean.
The president also reportedly calling the House bill, and I quote here, a son of a bitch.
That's right. Trump called the bill a son of a bitch, even though he repeatedly praised the bill and celebrated its passage. Although at times he made it sound like he didn't actually know what was in it.
We are coming up with something that I believe will be a very good bill that's going to be a phenomenal bill. This is a great bill. This is a great plan. And this will be great health care. We're going to have something that's going to be much more understood and much more popular than people can even imagine. The plan gets better and better and better, and it's gotten really, really good. And a lot of people are liking it a lot. This will be a plan where you can choose your doctor. This will be a plan where you can choose your plan. And you know what the plan is? This is the plan. It's a complicated process, but actually it's very simple. It's called good health care.
You know that dream you have where you have to give an oral report to the class and you didn't study at all? Oh, the Treaty of Versailles. What a good treaty it was. People talk about treaties, but oh, man. And I think that's my 10 minutes. It's been 8 seconds, Jeffrey. But this is one thing Trump is actually right about. The bill is mean. In fact, this is a rare area of bipartisan agreement. The bill is massively unpopular among both Democrats and Republicans. A poll out last week found that only 17% of Americans approve of the bill. And just 8% of Americans think the Senate should pass the health care bill as is. Meanwhile, the New York Times looked at polls in all 50 states and found that not one state favors it. This bill is less popular than the Baywatch remake, but at least the Baywatch remake had some health care in it. The bill has even earned some sassy remarks from lawmakers on Twitter, like Senator Bernie Sanders, who tweeted, "Breaking, Senate Republicans just released the schedule of hearings, committee markups, and public testimony for their health care bill, with a photo of a blank piece of paper." That's either a sick burn or Bernie just couldn't get the printer to work. What the hell is toner anyway? And Bernie isn't the only one frustrated by the secretive process. Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill tried to find out if Republicans would hold any hearings at all on their health care bill, a question that seemed to fluster Utah Senator Orrin Hatch.
So my first question that I would make of the chair is, will we have a hearing on the health care proposal?
Will we?
Yes.
I think we've already had one, but...
No, I mean on the proposal that you're planning to bring to the floor of the Senate for a vote. Will there be a hearing?
Will you? Huh?
Democrats have been invited to participate in this process, and we are open to their ideas and suggestions.
Well, I don't know that there's going to be another hearing, but we've invited you to participate.
Oh, man, that was like telling Grandpa who someone is. This is Kevin, Joe and Mary's son.
Oh, hey, hello.
Also, if there haven't been any hearings, then you haven't invited them to participate. You should come to dinner tonight. Great, where do you live? I'm not telling you. So Republicans are huddling behind closed doors to write a secret health care bill, and the president is bogged down by an escalating scandal. June 14th. Will forever be remembered as the day we found out the president was under investigation. Or if you're Trump, it'll be remembered as...
My birthday.
You've been a closer look.
Hi, this is Fred Armisen, the music director of the HG Band. Did you know that Late Night with Seth Meyers has a podcast now? That's what this is. And it's released every Wednesday and Friday. Tell your friends who love Late Night that they should subscribe at iTunes.com/LateNightSeth. You'll find it. What I just said, you'll be able to find it. I believe in you.
This is the director of Wonder Woman, which has been the number one movie in America 2 weeks in a row. Please welcome to the show, Patty Jenkins, everybody. How are you?
I'm good.
Congratulations on this wonderful film.
Thank you.
Your awareness of Wonder Woman was first, what? Was it Linda Carter? Was it the TV show?
I think, it's funny. I can't quite remember, like, when I saw the comic book versus when I saw the show. But I think it was the show that made us all fall in love with Linda Carter and then Wonder Woman, and then I started reading the comics.
It's such a wonderful film for all ages, but kids, I think it's a great movie for them to see this, you know, what is a really, strong female character in a comic book film. And one of your movie producers, one of the producers of the film, had a kindergarten teacher send her things that had happened in her class just in the week after people had seen it, the kids.
Yeah.
These are some of them. There was one girl that refuses to listen to you unless you address her as Wonder Woman. I think that's great.
Love it.
A boy threw his candy wrapper on the floor, and a 5-year-old girl screamed, "Don't pollute, you idiot. This is why there are no men in Themyscira."
So funny. So good.
And then I was talking to one of the girls that hadn't seen the movie, and the next day she came and very seriously told me, "You were right, Wonder Woman was way better than Frozen." And that is, I mean, that's some real high praise. From a little girl. But I think one of the nice things, and I don't know if you've found this out, is that for kids, they don't see this as this big moment in time where there's a female superhero. They just see it as a superhero movie that happens to have a female lead.
Yeah, that's what's sort of incredible, is because I have talked a couple of times about the fact that it was Superman, that I saw Superman when I was 7, and I was just watching a baby turn into a boy and then turn into a superhero and save the world, and I was like, I am Superman, you know?
Right.
It had that effect on me. But of course, then when Linda Carter showed up, I was like, oh my God, that's even more what I would want to be. So the fact that we're coming into a world where they get to now have a big movie like this, where it's a given that the superhero is a woman, and even like my own son watching how he's just like, oh, is that the new Wonder Woman? Let me see her sword. I need her.
Yeah.
You know, like he doesn't.
I hope you're getting a discount on the toys for how well you've done in this movie.
I'm like, you've got 3 Wonder Womans. He's like, but clearly, new sword.
Yeah,
that, right. And it's like, so it's so incredible to see that happening, where you're like, oh, sure, there's a female superhero, there's a male superhero, and it's awesome.
The first great battle scene in the film takes place on a beach, and you have basically half Amazons, half German soldiers. It's an incredible scene.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what the shooting of it like, the amount of choreography, and how was that?
Crazy. I mean, it was the craziest and most difficult scene that we possibly could have done, because it took weeks and weeks of planning and multiple beaches and all of these people. And then, you know, as much as theoretically you're making the Amazons and you're making the Themyscira, you're never really, I wasn't quite registering like, and ultimately this is going to feel like, instead I was like, oh, I need the best boxer in the world. I need the best, you know, like long jumper. I need, you're just going through all of these different things that you need. But then cut to months later, you're standing on a beach and there's like hundreds of these women coming at you in horses. And yeah, it was funny. I thought, because we also have all the guys playing German soldiers. And I really thought that it was going to end up being a situation where we had all these Wonder Woman babies. I was like, all these German soldiers and all these incredible women.
Yeah, meeting on a beach. Yeah.
But then meanwhile, the women were so incredible and intense and amazing that they were so intimidating as a mass that you went to the pool during the day when you weren't shooting. And instead, it was like this crowd of like, oh, the most beautiful supermodel in the world, Dotson Cruz, who's also an incredible horse rider, who's talking to the greatest boxer in history, Ann Wolf, and who's, I mean, it was just all these women and all the guys were just standing on the edge, like, totally not sure what to do. And I was like, this is the weirdest party I've ever been to in my life, you know?
It's like the women are adults and the guys are still 13 years old.
Yeah, totally. And all the women are just going wild at the pool and the men are like, I don't know exactly what to do in this scenario. It was really
now,
funny.
Now, I also imagine when you're directing a giant, big budget film like this, you don't have any sense of the place in history the film is going to be in regards to the fact that you are the first woman to direct a film of a superhero film of this budget. Did you have any sense of it when it was going on, or do you just have to focus on your job?
Yeah, I knew. I understood when I was hired, but I had almost done Thor too, the second Thor, and so it had already happened to me where I was like, I'm going to be the first woman. Oh, okay, not that one, but this one. So it's like I understood theoretically that I was the first woman to do it, but then nothing in both cases, when I was going to do Thor and when I was going to do this, I was like, none of this, you can't do anything with that information. You only can look at it and say, can I make a great film out of this? Am I the right person to do it? And so that's all there's room to focus on. A, the task of doing the first Wonder Woman film is serious.
Yeah.
Making a great superhero film I believe in, being the best director I can be, that's what I have to do. And then from there, you're like, sure, all of those other things. But of course, it's like fascinating then when you pull out and like records are being broken. And I really wasn't aware. I wasn't thinking about any of that. And they'll be broken again, and I'm excited to be a part in that chain, you know. But still, it's pretty incredible.
Well, you did incredible work, and I'm both proud of the work you did, and I'm proud of everybody showing up for it because it really is just such a wonderful story.
Thank you.
You told it so well. So thank you so much for being
here,
and congratulations.
So happy to be here.
Patty Jenkins, everybody. Wonder Woman from theaters and IMAX. Thank you.
Hey, everybody, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm backstage with Patty Jenkins, the director of the fantastic new movie Wonder Woman. Patty, I want to ask about your early directing jobs. You, of course, directed Monster. You did an episode or so of Arrested Development, the great show called The Killing. But what were some of your early directing jobs before you kind of took on these larger projects?
I did lots of short films, but I only did one job as a director before I did Monster, because I did Monster not long after I switched over to directing. And I had written it, and that's the only reason I got that job.
So
the only job I did was a music video in like 1993 for a hardcore band called Leeway.
Great.
Because I was in the punk scene, hardcore scene, and they were friends of mine, and they asked me to do it. And it's not a great video, but we had a lot of fun doing it. That was it.
That's fantastic. You grew up around the world. And I think you've said somewhere you grew up in kind of a feminist fantasy.
Yes.
What was your childhood like, and how did that maybe kind of lead to the types of projects you pursue now?
Well, so we lived all over the world a lot before I was in, you know, elementary school. And then we moved to Kansas, and my mother was there putting herself through undergraduate and graduate school. And I think it was just a very liberal, very open-minded town, very academic. And my mother was succeeding there, as difficult as it was. But so I think I was just living in a hotbed of like these ideals already existing.
Sure.
And so really the attitude, and I have only a sister, so there's no men around, you know, there were no, my father had passed away, so there was nobody showing us anything different.
Right.
So what my mom's ideals were living in our whole family. It was like, oh, you can do whatever you want, and it's been difficult, but not for you, you can go forward. And so I think I was just weirdly shielded from the idea that I couldn't, which is odd for me to look back and then think of, like, my mom was obviously struggling. Why did it never occur to me? That felt absolutely over to me.
Yeah.
I was like, too bad for the 50s. Thank God for the 70s. Here we go.
Right.
Like, this is all said and done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to ask about Wonder Woman. I'm curious how you kind of came up with the general look of the film. Because I feel like a lot of superhero movies now are very dark, gritty.
Yeah.
How did you decide what the film would look at? And when did you, in the process, kind of make the decision as to the visuals and the kind of overall imagery of the movie?
Yeah, I think that that's a very important thing with anything you're going to do. You have to really pick your tone and your look very carefully. There have been a lot of dark, gritty superhero movies. There have been a lot of edgy superhero movies. And there have been a lot of very popcorn, poppy superhero movies. And there's a place for all of them, and I love them all. But what I was missing was, like, grand cinema. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of missing that. I was missing that overall, which was Superman 1, Indiana Jones. Mm-hmm. You know, those movies that are, like, big, grand, epic films, but they're also funny, and it's also an adventure film. And so I just really felt like, wow, that's actually what it feels to me like Wonder Woman's begging for anyway. Mm-hmm. And it fits perfectly into the landscape of something that we're not seeing right now.
Right.
And, like, she's such a sincere, positive superhero.
Yeah.
That it felt like the right fit for her to have a great love story, for her to have an epic drama, for her to have this incredible journey, all felt really right. And so I just, my cinematographer and my incredible production designer and my whole crew, we just sat down and took very seriously, how can we make this as grand and beautiful and epic as possible?
Right. And Wonder Woman is all those things in your film, but she's also, like, she has self-doubts, and she's funny, she's human and multidimensional. And you've said that male superheroes have those traits all the time, but female superheroes aren't necessarily created that way.
Yeah, well, they are created that way, but there's something, there's been a weird chapter of feminism and equality and all of these things, which rightfully so, one of the steps of switching over to telling stories about different kinds of people was that other people besides them were very afraid to make them anything perfect.
Sure.
And that's a favor that you're not making women look dumb anymore, but it's a disservice if it means they have to be perfect and therefore two-dimensional.
Totally.
And so it was just an interesting step in the journey to universal storytelling for all kinds of people.
Right.
Is this kind of like, well, how do we do it without ever being insulting? Mm-hmm. And so really the ultimate victory of all of that is going to be when we can have a female lead who you can give absolutely everything to that you would give to a male lead. And I felt that was my place.
Yeah.
I was like, now's the time and I'm going to do it
because
I, as a woman, don't have to think about that. Mm-hmm. So I can just be a director directing a hero and I don't have to be afraid of that. And so it was super important to me that she have vulnerability, she have a need for love, she has uncertainty, she's funny in what she doesn't know. It's like Superman, Spider-Man, these are core things that make them as lovable as they are. It's like how they are your hero in the film trying to figure things out at the same time as they are a superhero.
She
I wanted to have that same dynamic. Don't worry about her the same way you're not worried about Superman and Spider-Man. They're gonna be fine. They have to fight, but they get to be a real big, rich character as well.
Totally. Last thing I want to ask you, I mentioned this earlier, Arrested Development.
Yes.
Can you tell us about the episode you directed? And
you
had done Monster before Arrested Development. These are very different projects.
Yes.
That
and
goes
I'd been
without
doing
saying.
Comedy before that, and I'd actually been doing comedy superhero short films before I did Monster.
You've done literally every genre. Pretty close?
It's funny, I don't even really think of myself as that kind of person, but it's true. I obsessively watch comedy. I grew up watching comedy. I know everything about comedy, and I dated a comedian for a long time, know lots of comedians. And so when the opportunity came to write and direct Monster, that was a great, I love true crime as well, and that's what I did. But the second I was done with it, I was like, oh, I started watching Arrested Development constantly just to recover.
Sure.
I'm obsessed with the show.
Best.
It was my favorite show.
So good.
And so I was like, I want to direct that show so badly. And everybody, I mean, all of those, the Mitch Hurwitz, who's the showrunner writer, all that cast, geniuses.
Brilliant.
All of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was so excited. You know, David Cross had been watching Mr. Show for years. And so I was so excited to go into that world. And the hilarious thing was, so, you know, I was friends with Jason Bateman and knew all of them a little bit. And they were like, great. Oh, this is wonderful. You're friends with these guys. That'll be fun to do for the actors and whatever. And then I didn't get the script until the Friday before we shot on Monday. And it just kept not coming. And then I sat down and at the production meeting, I got the script and they were like, okay, guys, this is the most ambitious episode we've ever done.
The one where they build a house, meaning we literally need to build a house and the house needs to collapse on hydraulics on Buster. And I just sat there like, okay, well, somehow that's going to happen on Wednesday because I think we had to shoot it on Wednesday. But it was just an amazing script.
It worked.
So funny. We pulled it off. Yeah. I mean, not unlike my directing career always. It's like, hey, man, if everybody's on board and we're going to shoot thousands of women on an Amazon beach, then we're doing it. You know, it's like you got to just roll with whatever you're handed and make it happen and make it work. But yeah, that episode was amazing. Fantastic. I love that the mayonnaise and thing has become.
It's an iconic part of the show now.
It's just amazing mayonnaise. That it's become that. That was so funny. I'll never forget the blocking of that scene, like standing there. And I loved the blocking of George Michael standing right there, and then he just steps to the side, and she's standing back there
with the egg.
Oh, I love it so much!
I got to rewatch it today,
so
and it's
so fun.
It's one of the all-time great episodes of Arrested.
That's so
I really,
great.
Really think it is. It's so great.
I am so happy to hear that.
Oh,
it's one of my very few big career regrets was that they had asked me to do more, and I thought my movie was going to go, and I was like, oh, I can't do it right now, but I'll come back. And then the show didn't go on, and I never got back. But oh, what a great time!
It was fantastic.
I loved it.
Monsters,
thank
fantastic.
You
directed
you.
Some of The Killing, which I loved.
Yeah, the
and Wonder Woman
and the
is
finale.
Those are some pretty big episodes. Yeah, those
were good.
The Killing.
Yeah,
and Wonder Woman is so fantastic.
Thank you
so much for being here. It was such a pleasure. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. This was great.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
What came first, the chicken or the egg? Spoiler alert, it's neither. At Happy Egg, we believe happiness of the hens is what actually came first. Because without happy hens, there would be no such thing as happy eggs. You know, eggs with delicious orange yolks. Those come from hens who are raised the happy way on 8-plus acres of family-owned farms. Choose happy at happyegg.com and look for the yellow carton at a store near you.
Happy
Egg.